This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Eleanor Hall. This Tuesday, as President Trump imposes new sanctions targeting Iran's leaders and the UN Security Council calls for restraint, just how close are the US and Iran to war? And reef grief. Scientists find years of angst about coral bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef have not inspired people to action, but instead paralysed them with fear.
Some of the emotions we identified included sadness, anger, disgust, and fear, and these are generally associated with emotions associated with grief.
But first this lunchtime, politicians may be arguing over the details of the federal government's proposed tax cut deal, but they all agree that some government action is needed to boost Australia's economy. Labor is now offering to pass the first two stages of the three-part tax cut package immediately. Economists and the community services sector support that, but are split on whether the third stage, aimed at helping high-income earners, is crucial. The real question is how those Australians set to benefit from the tax cuts will respond. Will they save the money or will they spend it? Gavin Coote has been investigating.
Get a bacon sandwich and a cup of tea. $9.
Considered by locals a reliable spot for a quick bite and some shelter from the morning rain, this modest shopping centre in the inner Sydney suburb of Redfern is where many are likely to spend their spare change.
You've got two extremes. You've got some very, very wealthy young families around here, you know, renovating and the rest of it. And on the other side, you've got the Housing Commission. So you see at the supermarket, you know, people scramble for their last 5 cents to sort of pay for an apple over the counter.
And with the first two stages of the government's income tax cuts soon likely to become a reality, low and middle income earners could receive up to $1,000 for singles and more than $2,000 for dual income families. These workers in Redfern expect to spend this money almost immediately.
Pay them extra bills that are coming in, like electricity just going up like a rocket, yeah?
So they're always going up.
Yeah, everything is going up for the year.
Straight to the mortgage. Yeah, straight on the offset account for the mortgage.
But others won't be so quick to part with the extra cash.
Maybe for travel? Yeah. Maybe for holiday? We'll save for a holiday, yeah.
Where do you reckon you'll go?
Maybe Fiji? Yeah.
So you'll save it in the first instance?
Yeah.
Oh, probably put it aside for a rainy day, you know. I've got a six-year-old, so, you know, plenty of school activities, that need money. So, you know, probably invest it that way or use it for around the home.
With economic growth slowing, both sides of politics agree income tax cuts are needed to give the economy a shot in the arm. It's what stages of the tax cuts that are needed where there's less agreement. Cassandra Goldie heads up the Australian Council of Social Service and says stage one is crucial for giving lower income Australians a leg up.
So we are absolutely backing stage one, which is well targeted. I mean, that's going to put cash into the hands of people on lower and modest incomes. But we think that the government's promise of being able to deliver all of these tax cuts and return the budget to surplus and guarantee essential services is just not real world.
Stephen Kokoulis is a leading economist and former advisor in the Gillard government. He doesn't dispute the need for these tax cuts, but he's questioning how big a difference it will make to the overall economy.
Tax cuts always provide stimulus to the economy. It's money going in to the pockets of consumers who predominantly spend it rather than going into consolidated revenue for the government. So, yes, it's a stimulatory measure, but it's not the sort of stimulus that's going to lead to a meaningful change in bottom-line economic growth.
AMP Capital Chief Economist Shane Oliver agrees it'd be a modest stimulus for lower and middle-income earners.
But by the same token, we did see, I guess a decade ago at the time of the DFC, when those checks in the mail, those stimulus checks were provided to Australian households, that some of that money did get spent, and that was one reason why we managed to avoid a recession at the time. So I think these first tranche of tax cuts is critically important and will help the economy.
And while the government's keen to push on with the third stage of tax cuts for those earning up to $200,000, not everyone in this bracket sees it as a priority. Vedran works as a psychologist and would much prefer to see his clients on lower and middle incomes get the relief.
Definitely in the line of work where I am. I think a lot of people that I work with will benefit a lot more from having better supports in the community, better schools, better hospitals, than having extra cash.
And that's one of those out shopping in the Sydney suburb of Redfern today, psychologist Vedran, ending that report from Gavin Coote. To Canberra now, where the political haggling over tax cuts is set to dominate the federal parliament when it returns next week for the first time since the election. Political reporter Stephanie Boris has the latest.
Parliament House is coming back to life with the latest political recruits in Canberra for Orientation Day.
I'm pretty sure this is the entrance, right?
This is great. It's exciting.
No nerves, though. Excited to be here.
Speaker of the House, Tony Smith, welcomed the new MPs to Parliament.
It's wonderful to see you here, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy the next couple of days learning about all of the rules and procedures.
And while the new MPs learn the ropes, their more seasoned colleagues are focused on tax cuts.
Mr Morrison just wants an argument rather than an outcome.
Labor is opposed to elements of the government's multi-billion dollar tax plan, and opposition leader Anthony Albanese wants it tweaked.
We are being constructive. We're offering to pass the first stage of the tax cuts, but to bring forward the second stage so that all workers will get a tax cut.
But the Prime Minister says there's no room for negotiations. Scott Morrison says if Labor doesn't support the tax package in full, Australians will receive no extra money. Shadow Finance Minister Katie Gallagher says that's not necessary and is urging the government to split up its plan so that the first and second stages are passed this year, benefiting low and middle income earners, while stage three, which will ensure 94% of taxpayers face a marginal tax rate of 30% or less from 2024, is dealt with later.
Stage three, what we've said is just defer that. Look, let's deal with the things we can agree on. Let's cooperate. The people of Australia want us to cooperate more. Let's defer those. You bring them back in the later July sittings or whenever you like.
There is another way the government could get its whole tax package through Parliament, and that's with the support of the crossbench. The votes of Centre Alliance Senator Rex Patrick and his colleague Sterling Griff are crucial. Senator Patrick says they're yet to decide whether they'll support the government.
We're not in a position to give a definitive answer at this stage.
He's raised concerns about the third stage of the tax plan.
What we need to make sure is that we don't end up with a situation where down track with a softening economy, we end up cutting health, education and aged care services.
Next Tuesday marks the start of the 46th Parliament. The first few days will be packed with ceremonial events, meaning tax cuts won't be debated until Thursday. The government will request that the Senate sit until all three stages of the legislation have been debated, meaning politicians could be sitting late into the night to work out a way forward.
Stephanie Boris reporting from Canberra. Well, the gig economy is often seen as a driver of job insecurity and worsening conditions for workers. But a report today from the advisory firm Ernst & Young takes a more positive view, predicting that the sector could add $22 billion to the economy and create 175,000 new jobs. Ernst & Young's chief economist Joe Masters spoke about the report to the ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan.
There are certainly jobs that will be at risk. Our modelling highlights, though, that in particular sectors of the economy, things like accommodation and food services, transport, IT, telecommunications, there will be net job creation. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that those jobs are equal to the jobs that may be lost in the economy. We accept that many of these jobs will be part-time, that many of them may have lower wages or not as stringent standards as we currently see, but there will be opportunities in those sectors.
Do you see this as a cultural shift as much as an economic shift?
Absolutely. I think it's going to change the way that we work. And we've seen this sort of disruption through history. Change will actually never be as slow as we're seeing it now. I think there's a lot of change coming in the future. So it's going to be a very different way that we work. And that's going to require different support and different education and training platforms.
You see $22 billion in potential economic growth and 175,000 new jobs. What areas stand out to be the big winners?
IT and telecommunications, accommodation and food services, and transport. The other interesting thing is our modelling doesn't just look at the direct job creation or job destruction in those sectors, but it looks at job creation up and down the value chain. And one of the interesting case studies was where we looked at administration and support services, where we will see quite significant job losses, but we do expect, based on our modelling, to see jobs created elsewhere in the economy. So things like IT, even though you've got a reduction in administration and support services itself directly.
You single out IT and telecommunications, and some of these are conservative old world businesses, for example, Telstra. Will those old style companies be the winners, or will it be the new nimble ones?
Look, I think when we look at those industries that already exist, like telecommunications, what we're seeing in the future looks very different. So they may still have jobs in those sectors, but those jobs and the skills required for those jobs is going to look very, very different. So from both a personal worker perspective and also a business perspective, you need to think about that pace of change and prepare for it.
But the outlook isn't so good if you work in administration or support services, where you say the gig economy is going to create quite a negative hit.
Absolutely. Our modelling suggests that if you got a 10% reduction in demand for administration and support services, that this economy could lose about 40,000 jobs in that sector. So that is absolutely significant, and that is a sector that will be hit quite hard.
You say it's important to look past the negative impacts of the rising gig economy, but that's easy to say unless you're a worker being exploited or seeing conditions eroded that others have fought pretty hard for.
That is absolutely an issue. I think the reality, though, is the gig economy is not something that is coming. It is something that is here, and the change is going to continue. And the question is, how do we as an economy train and reskill our workforce and ensure there's adequate levels of protection?
That's Ernst & Young Chief Economist Joe Masters with the ABC's Peter Ryan. This is The World Today, and if you miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe to The World Today wherever you get your podcasts. Heading overseas now, President Trump may have pulled back from a military strike on Iran last week, but overnight he imposed another round of sanctions. And today the United Nations Security Council met to discuss the increasingly dangerous situation. The UN ambassadors for France, Germany and the United Kingdom have jointly called for de-escalation and dialogue and warned of the risk of miscalculation and conflict. Rachel Mealy has the latest.
The Security Council is the UN's most powerful body. Today it held a two-hour closed-door meeting to discuss Iran. The Council condemned the recent attacks on oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman, labelling them a serious threat to international peace and security. Kuwait's ambassador to the UN is Mansour Al-Ataibi. He emerged from the meeting urging cool heads on all sides.
The Council members urge concerned parties and all countries in the region to exercise maximum restraint and take measures and actions to reduce escalation and end tension.
France, Germany and the United Kingdom spoke with one voice, warning that the increased tensions risk miscalculation and conflict. Germany's ambassador to the United Nations is Christoph Heusgen.
We call for de-escalation and dialogue with full respect for international rules. We reiterate our strong condemnation of attacks on the tankers in the Gulf of Oman, the acts of sabotage on four vessels off Fujairah, and any threat to the safety of maritime traffic and peace and security in the region. The attacks on tankers contravene international rules on freedom of navigation and maritime transport. They carry environmental risks, and they have the potential to further destabilize an already volatile region.
The three countries reiterated their support for the 2015 nuclear deal with Iran, known as the JCPOA.
France, Germany and the United Kingdom stress the commitment to the full implementation of Security Council Resolution 2231 and the preservation of the JCPOA, which we believe contributes to reducing tensions in the region as well as global nuclear non-proliferation.
Jonathan Cohen is the United States acting ambassador to the United Nations. After the meeting, he said the US remains committed to its sanctions program.
Iran must understand that these attacks are unacceptable. It's time for the world to join us in saying so. Our policy remains an economic and diplomatic effort to bring Iran back to the negotiating table. Iran should, as I said 2 weeks ago, meet diplomacy with diplomacy.
Iran isn't a member of the Security Council and its ambassador to the UN wasn't in the meeting. While the council was in session, Majid Takht Ravanchi reiterated Iran's position that the UN drone it shot down was flying over Iranian sea. He says the new sanctions announced earlier today by US President Donald Trump are an act of economic war against the Iranian people.
The US decision today to impose more sanctions against Iran is yet another indication of continued U.S. hostility against the Iranian people and their leaders, and that the U.S. has no respect for international law and order, as well as the views of overwhelming majority of the international community.
That's Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Ravanchi, ending Rachel Mealy's report. So just how close are the U.S. and Iran to war? Dr. Treaty Parsi is an associate professor at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University and the president of the National Iranian American Council. His latest book looks at how the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal was forged. He joined me a short time ago from Washington. Dr. Parsi, welcome back to The World Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, President Trump has announced a new round of sanctions on Iran, this time specifically targeting Iranian leaders. What do you think the president wants to achieve with these sanctions?
Well, more than anything else, he is signaling his bad intentions, frankly, because at the end of the day, those sanctions are not going to have any particular impact on the Iranian economy, but it will make it much more difficult to actually get them to come and negotiate. While on the one hand, he's saying that he's doing this because he wants to have negotiations, on the other hand, he's making negotiations more and more difficult, which then raises the suspicion that the ultimate objective at the end of the day may not be negotiations, but something else. Certainly from the perspective of someone like John Bolton and Pompeo, they have been counseling war for some time, as late as last Thursday, to be frank. So it is a strategy that clearly is geared towards more escalation rather than trying to diffuse the tensions.
So how do you expect the Iranian government to react?
Well, I think the Iranians are going to do what they could have done a year ago, but they waited somewhat patiently, which is to escalate their nuclear activities and put pressure on Europe, China, Russia to give the Iranians the economic benefit they were promised. And if Europeans don't, the Iranians will continue to escalate the nuclear program, and it's going to be a lose-lose for everyone. But at least under those circumstances, it seems like they calculate that they will gain some leverage compared to the current situation in which they're taking all the heat, they're paying all of the cost, all of the risk, yet none of the pressure or the risk is on Trump.
President Trump pulled back from a military attack on Iran last week, but the UN ambassadors for France, Germany and the United Kingdom have expressed grave concern today about the tensions in the Gulf. What do you think are the chances of war between the US and Iran?
Well, unfortunately, the risk of war is increasing by the day, because for every escalation that Trump is doing on the sanctions, he is eliminating whatever remaining off-ramps and exit ramps that existed for this maximum pressure strategy. So it does look quite grim, to be frank.
What are the off-ramps that you're talking about that you say President Trump is closing off?
If they at least kept some things open, perhaps one could be convinced that their ultimate objective is diplomacy. But particularly when rumor are now that they're going to be sanctioning Iran's top diplomat, how do you expect to have diplomacy if you're putting sanctions on the person you're supposed to negotiate? If they at least kept some things open, perhaps one could be convinced that their ultimate objective is diplomacy. What appears to be happening right now is that they're going all out on the sanctions front, which makes it very difficult, if not actually illegal, to pursue diplomacy. Because once these people are put on some of these sanctions lists, the U.S. government may not be permitted to have contact with them. So how are you going to negotiate if you can't talk to them?
And that's Dr. Treaty Parsi from the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown University. Back home now, Australia's top science body says years of reports about bleaching and coral death on the Great Barrier Reef have created a type of grief in tourists visiting the area. The CSIRO survey of visitors to the reef has found that far from inspiring them to action, the information about the impact of climate change is paralysing them with fear. Isabel Rowe reports.
The environmental health of the Great Barrier Reef has dominated headlines and conservation campaigns for years.
Australia could be the first developed country added to the United Nations environmental list of shame for failing.
We've lost a good portion of the world's corals due to primarily ocean warming.
An online article has taken the internet by storm with the simple title, Obituary, Great Barrier Reef, 25 million BC to 2016.
The stories often include scientists airing their concerns about the effect of climate change, agricultural runoff, coral bleaching during hot summers, and the spread of the reef-eating crown-of-thorns starfish. And it's a message that's heard around the world. CSIRO researcher Matt Kernock.
One of the first questions we ask are, what are the first words that come to mind when you think of the Great Barrier Reef? And some of the emotions we identified included sadness, anger, disgust, and fear. And these are generally associated with grief.
And now a study conducted by the CSIRO in conjunction with several Queensland universities shows that sorrow is a common emotion people associate with the Great Barrier Reef. Researchers spoke to more than 4,500 visitors to the reef, both Australians and international tourists. The majority saw climate change and pollution as the reef's biggest threat. Researcher Matt Kernock describes the feelings held by many as a type of reef grief. And he says some of the more sensationalised international media coverage is actually proving harmful.
The emotional appeals that are widely used in media representations are very successful in getting impact of a story and getting it to spread. But there's a side effect to that, and that's a reduction in people's perceived ability to take effective action to deal with the problem.
But despite their apparent worry, people still want to see it. Data held by the reef's governing body shows tourist numbers haven't dropped off. And when first-time visitors pop on the goggles and dip below the water, reef tourism expert Dr. Dean Miller says they'll be amazed.
A lot of the people probably have never even snorkelled before. And so for those guys, they're going to have the best day of their life out there.
Dr. Miller works with advocacy group Great Barrier Reef Legacy.
There is a huge misconception out there that the Great Barrier Reef is dead. It's absolutely not dead. You've got to look at an economic standpoint and go, okay, it's worth, you know, $56 billion to the economy. That's fantastic. We need to continue that attraction.
Campaigns to save the reef are run by environmental groups such as the Australian Conservation Foundation. ACF Chief Executive Kelly O'Shaughnessy agrees reef grief is prominent, but says it's not an overreaction.
It has bleached. 30% of the reef corals died after the 2016 mass bleaching and more again in 2017. So we can't sugarcoat these things, but we should be talking about in equal weight the solutions.
And that's Australian Conservation Foundation Chief Executive Kelly O'Shaughnessy, ending that report from Isabel Rowe. Well, staying with concerns about climate change, 150 religious leaders from across the country have signed an open letter to Scott Morrison calling for a halt to all new coal and gas projects in Australia and urging the Prime Minister to act on climate change. They formed the group, the Australian Religious Response to Climate Change, which is meeting today. Henry Swartz has more.
It takes all of Rabbi Jonathan Karenblack's lung power to bellow out a blast from a traditional Jewish ram's horn. He's sounding the alarm for not only his community, but for all Australians.
The shofar, the ram's horn, we use it to awaken people from their slumbers and to sound the alarm. So by blowing it, we are waking up people to the climate emergency and to the state of the world.
The rabbi is one of a diverse band of religious leaders who believe the country is facing an impending climate catastrophe. They met today at a uniting church in Paddington in Sydney's east. Imam Ahmed Abdo from the New South Wales Council of Imams says Islam, Christianity and Judaism all need to see eye to eye on environmentalism.
Today's a day where we're sending a very strong and clear message to our leadership in Australia that we've got no faith in coal. We're calling for renewable energy sources to be on the increase. We're calling for people to work towards a more sustainable planet to live in. As Muslims, we see the first human being that walked on earth was Adam, and God calls Adam his vicegerent and his steward. So we've got this entrusted responsibility to take care of the earth. Let there be no harm nor the reciprocating of harm. Show mercy to all people. The best in the sight of God are those who are most beneficial to his creation. So this is really part and parcel of the daily ritual of a person of the Muslim faith.
Catholic nun Sister Libby Rogerson was also at the meeting.
Creation is a gift to all of us and we should be doing everything we can to preserve it.
The point the religious leaders are making is that climate change is a moral, not political, issue. Imam Abdo believes people and politicians need to work together.
I think religions have got more in common than they have differing between them. And so this is one of those common factors that can unite people and bring people together. And it's just so inspiring and energising to see this issue, as a common denominator that brings people together.
That's Imam Abdo from the New South Wales Council of Imams, ending that report by Henry Swartz. And that's all from the World Today team for this Tuesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Eleanor Hall. Have a lovely afternoon.
Hi, I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell. And today on The Signal, we're going inside the wellness crystal trade.
Yeah, so there's a crystal boom on at the moment, but tracing their source is a different story. Plenty of crystals are mined unethically, using child labour or damaging the environment, and it's almost impossible to know which ones to trust.
Today on The Signal, we go deep on the crystal trade, from the shop front...
You are holding a piece of Mars.
Really?
What?
All the way back up the supply chain.
That's The Signal. You can hear us every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you usually find podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.